When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Special guest this week, Spencer Segura. What's happening, boys?
Hey, Spencer's in town. His mom still lives in town here, so he's here to see her. And I met Spencer for lunch at the Beverly Hills Tennis Club. Now, that is a name from the past. That's where I first came. I met Spencer. We were 15 years old to work with his dad. So it's kind of some good old memories from there.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Good to see you, Brad. I remember before you were born, even. That's how long I've known you. But it's great to come back to the great weather of Southern California. I'm living in Darien, Connecticut, which is a beautiful place, but it's the East Coast.
Yeah, not exactly.
So I miss the weather. And so whenever I get out here, I just love it. And so today I was at the Beverly Hills Tennis Club where, you know, Jimmy and I kind of grew up from the age of, I was there from the age of about 12. He got there when he was about 15. Great memories, great tennis, probably the mecca of Southern California tennis, including, of course, the LA club, which had the tournaments, but we had the players.
Yeah.
Basically.
Well, but when his dad was there, I mean, you know, for me to come there, it was an eye opener. You know, Brett, I came from a little town in Illinois, and all of a sudden to be at the Beverly Hills Tennis Club, and I'd hit it with Spencer, and we'd sit around and have a Coke, and all of a sudden Pancho Gonzalez and Charlie Passerell and Rod Laver and Ken Rosewall and Stan Smith and, you know, would all pass through and want to play there. So the tennis that not only you could play but also could watch was pretty spectacular. But back in those days, you know, Spencer and I, you know, we grew up, we played together, we went out on the circuit together, and I think after 3 or 4 years on the circuit after I turned pro, Spencer deserted me and went to law school.
Oh God!
I said you're giving up tennis for that
backup plan.
That was like going to Crowbar College. That was brutal, but it was a great time there. And
how has it changed?
Well, the club, my dad was the pro until like 70, but we're aging ourselves. But after 70, when he left, he went to La Costa, which was a very beautiful tennis mecca also, which he built it into. Started out with 4 courts and ended up being about 28 courts. We had 2 grass, 2 clay. Big tournament. Jimmy, I think, won it once. Everybody played the tournament. But what happened was sort of a migration away from the Beverly Hills Club of the great players, because the tennis just kind of evaporated through the 80s. And then just recently, it's had a huge resurgence through Joe Sugarman, who's a famous ENT doctor and tennis enthusiast who, kind of like loves tennis and encouraged got Jimmy to come back, got a lot of the top players to come just to be there and reminisce. And then all of a sudden it's where Osaka practices. It's where when Djokovic's in town for the Palm Desert, all the players were there. Tommy Haas is living in LA. He plays there, teaches his daughter there. So all of a sudden it's got all these players. And now there's a waiting list of over 30 people, 30 families. It's sold out. It's not a cheap club. I think it's like $25,000 to join and 15 or so in dues. So 5 courts, a steam bath, and a dining room, basically a swimming pool.
Right. Yeah. Let's be fair though. Yeah. When your dad was there, your dad was the draw.
Yeah, my dad was loved to loved people. He had all the movie stars.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys said a lot of tennis names, but that's like only half of them.
No, right? So you had all the movie stars there, and you had
Give me some names.
Well, I'll give you one little story. There was this very pretty girl working in, this is how I recall it. You know, when they tell stories, sometimes they change as everybody tells them.
Embellished. But,
Candy Spelling, the wife of Aaron Spelling, evidently was working in Jack's, which is a very high-end women's store where only beautiful ladies were allowed to work. And my dad invited her over, and he was thinking that she should meet Kirk Kerkorian. And she ended up meeting Aaron Spelling at the club, I think. There's stories like that. Another, there were so many of these gorgeous girls. My dad liked women, I guess that's good.
Think.
And so we had all these starlets, too, that wanted to meet the man of their dreams. All the big agents were members, the producers. Richard Zanuck was a member. The Gersh family was their big agents. You had every act. So what were the actors? Kurt Douglas, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra.
Gilbert Roland,
yeah. The old film star. You had all the silent film from Groucho Marx. Go back. Richard Widmark, Frederick March, all the old movies. Charlie Chaplin. They were all members.
I love Chaplin.
So many
Buster Keaton.
I'm leaving out a lot. I don't know. I'm leaving out a lot of members and directors and writers. So it was a unique club.
Bob Town.
Robert Town took lessons from my dad. You had all the Jimmy Kahn took case to come there when he was on his way up, starting out. So we had all those guys around, and they liked tennis. They're watching us. We're like 15, 16. They wanted to play or hang out. So we got some of that benefit. We get to go. They invite us places, and it was a happening. It was a real unique era, which I think was 60s and early 70s, the end of the glamorous part of, in my opinion, the real glamour of Hollywood, where people came from all over the world to try and make it in Hollywood, multi-talented, from stage actors to, remember the Michael Crawford, remember him?
So
Michael Crawford was the Phantom, of the opera. He was a great song and dance trained guy from England. He could really do everything. He came out to do Hello, Dolly, and I played tennis with him, and we held a tournament in his name at Jack Hansen's, and you had everybody there from Warren Beatty, Steve McQueen. They all watch all the matches, and Michael then went on to become a huge star through multiple,
That's cool, though, that Osaka's playing there, and a lot of the players now, kind of like Bridges, that's come full circle.
I mean, you had an average day, Jim will tell you. You had Ash and Passerell from UCLA. This is when we were really young. You had Smith. My dad taught Smith from his age of 12. So you had Smith once a week. Those guys were there when we were 15. And then you had Gonzalez just come see my dad and play there every day. If he was in town, he was there every day. So when we went to UCLA, you had most of the UCLA team. You'd bring over like Jeff Austin or the Christ family. We're all good, great players. So you had so much depth that every court had a good game on it.
Southern California, said it was the mecca of tennis.
Yeah, it really was.
And we had UCLA, USC were the powerhouses of tennis back then. And you go to the LA Tennis Club, and we could play for 2 weeks every day, twice a day, and never play the same player twice. Practice with them twice.
Right.
And what an education for us young and our dreams were to try to be as good as we could be and go out on this tour and be the best in the world. That's what our dreams were. So to have that that kind of competition and that at our fingertips just daily. Yeah. All you had to do was make a call and you had
to go to UCLA. He's not going to get mad at me, but he started out as three on the team.
Yeah.
Harun Rahim from Pakistan and Jeff Broviak was one. Broviak had won the NCAAs. We had 12-man team. We had that many. We had 12 good players. The number 12 wouldn't give Jimmy a good match, but it wouldn't be a bad match. Yeah. It was that. And balance. He was just coming up. So you had this great competition. He didn't even have to leave UCLA.
Right.
Now you leave UCLA, and you've got Ash, everybody, Gonzalez at the Beverly Hills Club. So that was like the extra edge that he had going for him. That not everybody he got to play the best players in the world from, I'd say 17 on, literally.
And that's and back then
and they were all right here. We didn't have to go anywhere. There. What time you want to meet me?
Yeah.
And it wouldn't even make that. You show up. Gonzalez said, "I'll see you around 3:00." you're playing the number one of the greatest players in the world, just says, maybe I'll play and you come over.
And you're waiting.
You're waiting.
It didn't matter how long. You sit there and wait for him. And But Pancho Gonzalez was a one of a kind. I mean, he come in, I remember first meeting him and seeing him play. And for 2 or 3 weeks, he'd just walk right by me, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, he comes in and he says, I'm hitting with you in 5 minutes.
How old was he then?
Was 40s.
In his 40s.
Yeah.
And you're like 17, 18?
Yeah. Oh, no, earlier. 15, 16.
Yeah.
And he's a big dude. He's not, he's kind of intimidating. 16.
He was intimidating.
He doesn't say hello. He had a sort of chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
And which is, that's an interesting story.
But it was a good chip.
I feel like he doesn't get enough love in tennis.
He felt, and if you look back on it, the guy was, came from a middle-class Mexican family from downtown L.A., and he felt that he was discriminated against, which he probably was. And so he had the big chip on his shoulder. Whereas my dad didn't have any of that. But my dad's idea was, you're in America, you got a shot.
Yeah.
Gonzalez is what they're trying to screw me. and that translated through his whole life. But it made for such an exciting guy on the court. Because I watched today's guy. Well, I don't want to say anything about today, but he drew in the audience tremendously, as did my father, as is Jimbo and Nasty. And, you know, there's a handful of guys that really drew the entertainment part of tennis, and it's sad most of them were back then. Maybe it's the rule changes, but I don't, you know. So, but this guy was dynamic. Everybody, he sell out every crowd, you know. Yeah.
But it's good to see the resurgence of the Beverly Hills Club, all that. And I hope those who come understand what it was back then and try to keep that that reputation alive. Be good.
Seems like they will. I think one of the cool things that you're saying about having that many people at your fingertips back then was people played so many different styles, you know, like with the technology and everything now, like it almost makes it so you have to play a certain way, you know, at least 80% of your game or something, you know. Yeah. But back then you had serve and volleyers, you guys stayed back, chip and chargers, you know, like, so you were able to have so many practice partners that helped sharpen you against each tactic.
Yeah, that's so Jimbo was, you know, Jimbo was not a cement type player when he came out.
No,
he was more, he didn't miss a ball, super quick, never missed a ball. You had to, you know, wear it, but he didn't play aggressive at first.
Yeah. How would you say he changed the most from when you first saw him play to what he became?
Well, I think his return was always very good, but once he started step, he would take the ball on the rise much more and then come into the net behind his shots.
Follow
not
in.
First shot, but he'd come in, you hit two balls and he's on top of you. Where he first came, he didn't have that. He was growing still, but he didn't apply that to the extent that he would use to dominate the game. And that's how his game, you know, when you're saying everybody has a different style, so the guys like Stan Smith or Arthur Ashe that were out here, serve and volley guys, and depending on their serve, they lived or died and the surface. So you go play Wimbledon or U.S. Open, the ball didn't bounce then. They've changed the whole game by making the ball come up. So a guy like Smith, he could dominate in those and get do well at those tournaments. He goes to the French Open. He's a first-round loser. Stan, I'm sorry if you're here listening to this. I don't know if you lost the first round, but he probably could be a first-round loser. Arthur Ashe, great player. He would play Davis Cup against Ecuador, lose to Pancho Guzman on clay. These guys could not play on clay. You were more of a, you had more of a clay court game than them. So today, that game is out of fashion. So that's maybe why Southern California, not a lot of clay courts. All the big serve and volley game gone out of the game because they changed the game to slow it down to make it more like a clay game to favor European style playing. And they've done that, and that's kind of what you're seeing today. The game is basically clay on all surfaces.
Homogenized.
Yeah, and so I think it's been damaging because everybody playing the same, it's boring. It's like watching ping pong.
Yeah, so, for the record, Stan Smith, 2 first-round losses at the French Open.
So I just guessed that.
But also 2 grand slams.
Oh,
so
yeah,
not so bad.
On grass.
It's okay.
So then Jimbo comes along, and he's got this return. And Stan Smith's not super fast, but he's fast. He's not fast
height,
like Nasty, or he's not lightning fast. Okay, he's not like Monfi or Federer.
Well, he's a pretty tall guy, though.
He's too tall. Yep. But so then you get a guy. This guy's returning your serve as hard as you're serving it, almost. So now guys are having. So by stepping in with his return that he had, that no one had, he was able to dominate the game.
So,
I think also, right, because so much of the game was serve volley and one-hand backhands, that you would catch a lot of people probably on their way in. You know, you'd step in, take that time, and you'd catch them in that no man's land on their way into the net.
Not so easy to do, though.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that was probably big because so many guys came to net.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, and you had to play defensive.
Yeah, but nobody else could do it. Yeah.
So. But better just to go one step further, your grandma, my mom, and two mom gave me my game. And when I came out here, I had a game.
Yeah,
When I came out here, your dad refined it.
Right.
And
more aggressive, making more aggressive.
Made me more aggressive and more aware of, because my mom, the reason my mom, and I've said this over and over and over, that gave me to your dad, and by the way, was the only one she would have given me to.
Yeah.
What was for that reason? Because she knew that she had taken me as far as she could, and I needed a male influence,
right?
You know, to go out and play against the best players. And when he refined my game, and then I started growing, and started growing into that game. But from my standpoint, I was never afraid to take what either my mom or Pancho gave me, and take it right to the court.
Right.
You know, I
put
trust
it into practice.
The matches.
In the matches.
Right away. Yeah. I said they weren't going to bullshit me. I mean, they were going to do something that was good for me. I trusted them that much.
You got lucky in the sense that your mom really understood the game, and, and my dad, you got two unbelievable teachers, and you listened, and you were a good competitor.
But I mean, why waste time doing it in practice when you?
But you could you could have got it done. But what if he'd gotten a bad coach?
Yeah.
What if he'd gotten one of these manufactured coaches that is out there right now?
Just bounce around.
And does never played, never knew how to play. Maybe knows how to teach you stroke, but doesn't know how to play the match. So that can make a big difference in a career from a guy like who can make you a champion much sooner. And who knows, you might get injured and never made it.
Yeah, I always find that interesting. That some of the coaches, you know, you're like, you see them and they're in the box and they're coming on the court. And I mean, I get that they know what they're talking about, but you're right. Like some of them, you're like, well, like, why would I listen to you? I mean, how do you even know?
That's
like,
a good point.
You've just heard other people who have been in that situation talk about it or tell you what they think because you've never been in it.
Right.
So it's, you know, having someone who's been there and knows it is
such a
different
thing. Well, like I see it's interesting now, Jimbo, because a guy says to me, he says, you guys, you're 68, Connor's 68. What do you guys know about tennis now? I said, well, I don't know.
Well,
what do you think? I tell you what, I was around my dad. I've been around Jimmy. I played myself. I got better as I got older. And I've learned, and I'm now taught a kid. And I say, I can tell you now that to understand the game, you have to play those matches to be in his level. So anybody who's done what he's done, there's no normal coach that could coach you. So guys that are saying, oh, I'm going to go to these, like kids today, if some kid could come to Jimmy and have him coach, or he could go to the USTA or a French Federation and have any of their coach, it's not even close. I mean, it's like, how could anybody think that?
Yeah.
But yet people do.
Yeah.
And that's, you know.
I think a lot, you know, a lot of the people, like you say, they think the game's passed us by, you know, but if it was, you know, like a lot of the older guys who were sitting in the stands when I was playing, they hung on their every word.
Right.
You know, whether it was Budge or, you know, a lot of the guys who, Tony Trabert, guys that were around the game.
Yeah. They're hell of good players.
But pre-me.
Yeah.
They would hang on their words that, you know, well, what about Connors? You know, and they'd make a comment about Connors. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, you know, well, you know, they'd hang on that. And now they think, you know, if we would say something, they say, well, you don't know. The game's passed you by.
Yeah. You know what the thing is, you got to be a complete tennis player. I mean, I think it's a big advantage. So what is a complete tennis player? A guy who can hit through the ball, slice, serve and volley, play the full court. So if he's in short, he can angle you off. He doesn't have to stand 2 feet back and only hit the ball 5 feet over the net. He has to have that shot too today, to a degree. But you can't take that away, that if you have an all-around game. So you see a lot of these kids today have one way of hitting the ball all the time and just do that. And then somebody like Federer can mix it up. He can slice. He can angle you off. Nadal got a great slice approach.
Murray.
He can volley. Murray.
Tsitsipas now.
Tsitsipas,
he's great at net for his age.
And he's an attacker. He's an attacker.
He's always trying to get forward.
Yeah, I would say I think one of his issues is his ball sets up a little on his forehand and on his back. He's got great game. But, I mean, I think he needs, with his height and his power, he needs to keep that ball down a little lower instead of whatever, on his approaches at least.
Yeah. I think he could has the talent to be one, though, someday once, you know, the big three kind of retire.
Well, yeah.
I think it's interesting, though, with the coaching stuff that, like you say, everybody has, like, a you know, a good game. When they get to the pros, everybody can hit these shots, and these coaches can tell them the fundamentals and give them everything in the books and all the stuff and teach them strategy. But then it always comes down to, it seems, the, you know, because everyone's so close. It's so razor thin, like with golf also. You know, the difference between pro and, you know, not pro is, like, a tenth of a stroke or something maybe one year. Mm-hmm. And so it ends up coming down to, like, intangibles.
Right. Well, and I agree with you.
And how do you teach intangibles?
You don't.
You know? Well, so that's why I think dad and your, my dad and your dad, it was so lucky because they were both like sponges to one another. You know, your dad had all the info, but was also open to probably, you know, his take. You know, Pop's
intangibles
take.
Are the champions, you know, that I mean, I've seen probably, I've seen a lot of them, but very few that I would consider. Like, I watched my dad play under huge pressure, big points, always playing his best. Jimbo would be playing mediocre. You get to 30 all, he's a different player. Get to break point, it's a different player. He's always playing better on the big points, playing better in tournament than they do in practice. Can't hit a ball in practice, have a flu, come out and play well. How? That's the intangibles. But I also think it helps to have a weapon in tennis. Or used to. I mean, he had the great return. You got to have a great, you have one big thing, it opens up the court for you. Today's game, which when people are standing 2 feet back, even though they have the big, they just put the serve in play, the return. So
2 feet back is hugging the line.
Yeah, that was, I was just going to say.
So you put the ball in play, and now you've taken away the big return, and it's a rally. Now it's going to be a roadrunner game, and now that's why you have the great, one of the greatest players of all time, and now is Nadal, because he has everything, but he doesn't have a huge serve, and he doesn't have a huge return. He has very good. But what beats him is once they hit that ball down the middle, he's got the greatest forehand topspin maybe in history, pulls him out, opens the court, and he wins that way in this running game. Mm-hmm. So the whole game has really changed from, whereas you came in on Jimbo, you're lucky to hold serve when he's playing his best tennis. Borg is, you know, Borg passed, you have the greatest passing shots maybe on the run ever seen, never missed a ball, never missed a return. Borg kind of played a lot like these guys, but they would say he's flat probably too.
Right. Who do you think his games is most like? I know most people compare him to Nadal because of his fighting spirit and the fact that they never give up, but that's not his style.
No, Djokovic.
I almost think Joker.
Very much.
Right?
Easier. Much easier. Much complete. Djokovic returns deep. The only way he beats Nadal is returning, giving him no time.
Steps in.
If he rallied with Nadal on the first return,
good at
he
net,
would never
good
win.
Enough at net.
You He's know. Good enough at net, but he hurts him with the return.
But like, the whole thing about it seems like to me, being around it, the little that I am, but the word neutral. Is big, you know. Well, I want to return and I want to start out in
neutral.
Get back to neutral.
Yeah.
You know, I was never.
Yeah, that's weird.
I was never looking for neutral.
Well, I mean, I understand. The weird part is, I think that too. Like, they're always like, get back to neutral, which you get when you're in a defensive position. You know, because you're just trying to essentially say, get back in the point.
Right.
You know, if you're just running like a roadrunner side to side. But the thing I can't believe is how many times someone will play the first three or four shots of a point great, get control, open it up, get a short ball, and then retreat.
Okay.
Or reset, you know,
that's
so.
A
then
big mistake,
they almost have to win the point two and three times sometimes.
Well, and let's be honest, it is harder to win the. Now you open the court and you don't retreat. It seems to me that if you're just going to come in with a good approach with these balls and these courts
and these rackets,
it's a much harder thing than it used to be.
Yeah,
so it's you have to
now.
Use
you
that.
Can get past a lot easier.
Yeah, a lot easier. The ball doesn't move like the old ball. Remember, this bounces maybe twice as high every ball. If you slice through like a guy like he could, or even I hate to make it seem like ancient Rose Wall or guys like that who had the slice that just was a knife, on the old days, that ball didn't even come up. You were lucky to get under it to get it to the guy at net.
The courts were so different then. Even the grass was different, number one.
Yeah.
The clay was different, number two. The balls were different there.
Yeah.
And plus the indoor courts that we played on was a very thin carpet called Supreme Court, which, you know, came through like a shot also. So, you know, the lower you kept the ball,
the better.
The better.
And you played on wood too, right?
Yeah, I grew up on wood, yeah.
Yeah. See, wood is like
ice.
It's beyond. The ball doesn't bounce at all.
I don't know. Yeah. I just feel like I feel like it's still the fundamentals, though. Like, if you have the control of the point and the person's out wide and
yeah, you should be able to, if you're big enough.
Like, I still feel like make them hit a sick pass on you.
Okay, so you need to have a great all-around game today.
Yeah.
These guys have great ground strokes. They have great games. A lot of them, because they never come to net anymore, lack those shots that could separate them and make them way better.
So, and also following the ball on
a better
on
approach.
The approach.
Yeah,
they have an angle approach.
Yeah.
Angle approach.
Yeah, sometimes they'll hit it right at down the middle and then come in. And you're like, you know, like it's in their pocket. You know, they can go backhand or forehand if they want.
Well, I think eventually I've said for the last number of years that the next great player is going to be a hybrid.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just what we're talking about. One who knows how to play this game, you know, with the understanding and the ability of a Segura mind or a Gonzalez mind,
right.
You know, and to be able to mix up his shots like that instead of, you know, which is, you know, I guess the day would be the closest would be Federer and Joker.
Yeah.
You know, and then maybe
Tsitsipas.
Yeah. I think Tsitsi, as far as the younger guys, is that.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, he's been good at the net for years now, you know, and he's like, whatever, 23 or something, but he's been good net player since he's been 19. Whereas, you know, watch, like, Sinner's great, but watch how long it's going to take him a while to become, like, solid enough at net.
He hits the ball a little better off the ground.
You know, or even Zverev when he gets to net. It's dicey sometimes, you know? So, like, watch how long it's going to take those other guys to become serviceable, quote unquote, where, like, Tsitsipas is, like, at the net. That's the sound of another sale on Shopify. And the moment another business's dreams become reality. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. No matter what you're selling, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person so you can focus on successfully growing your business. Shopify covers every sales channel from an in-person point-of-sale system, an all-in-one e-commerce platform, and even lets you sell across social media marketplaces like TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify is there to empower you with the confidence and control to revolutionize your business and take it to the next level. Now it's your turn to get serious about selling and try Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Connors, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/Connors for a $1 per month trial period.
So let's take the example of Nadal and Zverev. Zverev's got the perfect game to hurt Nadal. He's 6 foot, what, 5'4"?
Yeah, something like
got
that.
Got the great backhand. He has the depth on his backhand. From 4 feet behind, he's hitting backhands that are just beyond belief, okay? Mm-hmm. Nadal whips that lefty hook out to his backhand. It doesn't bother him, okay? So that's today's players. Zverev and Nadal is a classic example. If you leave out the three players you just mentioned, they all play like that, except those guys are the best at it. Nadal's the best at the topspin, and Zverev's got the height to counter him. Just like Medvedev could have beat him, you know. He's got a game to beat Nadal and cement. Otherwise, everybody plays like those guys, but they're shorter versions.
Zverev has that nice backhand. That's why he's able to exploit Nadal, because he's normally spinning that up high to people's backhand, and Zverev's 6'6", sitting there waiting for him.
Plus, he's returning huge off the backhand, too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
But if you're that height and you can take that high bounce away from Rafa, you know, and catch it a little bit early, it doesn't have that spin, doesn't have time to push you back,
right?
You know, so
and you prevent him from doing it, right.
And take away a split second.
So that's what his game. We can't argue, but his type of game could potentially have done to these guys. So when people say, "Oh, the players today are 100 million% better," they really haven't played somebody who does that, what he did. Take the ball early, keep it down on him. The ball wouldn't have taken off as big, but it would have been down. So they're not going to be hurting him with that tie. They're not going to be, he's not going to be here every ball.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to let him do it to him. So that's what Zverev could do. He could improve, by the way. I'm not saying I love his
game. He's got a lot of potential
still. Because he's so big and such a good backhand and such a good, he has a good serve. Mm. He's just no confidence.
The second serve.
Yeah.
It's one of the more exciting shots in the game.
Yeah, he's got no confidence. For a great player with no confidence, for a hell of a player with no confidence, and then.
But he's able to still make these runs and semis and finals with the serve going haywire. If he can lock that down, then it's
He's
going
to be
dangerous.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's just talk about some of the results. We're in the middle of clay court season. We're in the thick of it. Rome is going on right now. We just came off Madrid, where Zverev won, beat Berrettini.
Yeah, I like his game, too.
Seems like the altitude played a big role there.
Good point there.
Did you play Madrid?
I did.
Yeah.
And
did you win it once?
Check,
please.
but I liked playing there because it did go faster, and the ball traveled through the air faster, and Zverev, you know, with the way he hits the ball, and Berrettini also is big and strong and hits the ball. I mean, I can see where that benefits them, but leading up to that, from Monte Carlo to Barcelona to Madrid. You know, it just hasn't been, you know, a Nadal circuit.
It's been some variety.
Yeah, which has been good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's good leading into the French to have some guys. So, you know, Tsitsipas won Monte Carlo.
Which is a 1,000.
Yeah, Masters 1,000. Yeah. Nadal won Barcelona, which 500.
500.
Yeah. Still a big tournament.
Big tournament.
He's won that, I think, 11 times now or 12. It's ridiculous. And then last week, Zverev. But also with the altitude, you're right. From a gambling perspective, I have a buddy I talked to, and he was saying, he's like, it's going to be a big deal this week.
Serving.
The servers, yeah. He's like, watch out for the servers more this week than any of the other weeks. Because, you know, Monte Carlo, it rains a lot, it gets slow. You know, rains a lot in Rome. They don't have roofs. They have a roof in Madrid.
Yeah.
So, like, the clay never absorbs as much of the moisture you know, from nature as it would in the other places. So, and then also on the women's side, Sabalenka won. You know, Sabalenka's, her and Barty have kind of been the two best players on tour this year. Sabalenka kind of, you know.
She's a hard hitter.
She crushes.
She's
huge. She hits, she hits early.
When she's
she
on.
Attacks.
Yeah, she does. She takes it early. Yeah. She's decent at doubles, has a couple Grand Slam, I think, doubles wins. But she beat Barty, who I like a lot. Barty's been pretty consistent. You know, she won Miami. She won Yara. She won another tournament. I can't remember what it was.
She's got three wins this year already. That's impressive.
Yeah,
that's impressive.
Another final. So I like her. She's consistent. And as far as, like, you know, variety, you know, a lot of, like you say, a lot of the players today play one way. And if that doesn't go right, they just keep going at it.
Yeah.
And so to see
but
someone.
She's just not also successful in just one surface.
No.
Yeah, she's got that more all around game
Spencer
was talking
about. She
crushes
the second serve.
I think if you asked her, she'd say grass is her favorite.
I would think so. Mm-hmm. But that power.
She won the French. I'm talking Barty.
Barty.
So,
Barty's got all around.
Totally.
Big all around. Game.
Yeah. She has options if something, if she loses the first set, she can like kind of reassess and try something different. So, you know, I think it's interesting. But on the men's side, three winners. We'll see what happens in Rome. Djokovic is playing this week. Fed doesn't play till next week in Geneva. So, you know, multiple winners. We can talk some of the odds going into the French. What do you guys think? Do you guys think, is Rafa another auto pick? Do you just lock him in? Because every year it's
what are the odds on him?
Pretty much the same. If you want Rafa, he's pretty much even money, plus 110.
Yeah, I mean,
he's
getting older.
Listen, and going into a Grand Slam, you never know what can happen. It's a 2-week tournament.
Yeah,
you're playing on the heavy clay. You'll be grinding, running down a lot of balls. You know, a lot of things can happen there. 7 matches to win it.
Yeah,
you know, what's he won it? 13,
I think,
130 times, something like that in a row.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, it's, you know, that's a record that certainly won't be broken.
Yeah.
But you know, things can happen, and you know, not that he's lost confidence because he did win in Barcelona, but be interesting to see what happens in Rome, and then going into the French, and you know, the first couple rounds there. You know, I think for somebody like that, he'd be looking to. kind of break his way into the tournament. I mean, they're not going to throw him a Zverev in the first round.
No.
You know, so, you know, he'll work his way into the tournament, you know, that he's not going to go in there expecting that, but he's going to go and say that, you know, I hope that I can work my way into this tournament a little bit, so that, you know, I played a lot. He's played four tournaments leading up to the French.
Great.
He's tired, man. I don't think I ever played four tournaments in a row in my life.
No, I don't.
He'll take next week off, though. He won't play the actual week before.
I think he's got one issue. I mean, I think he's better. He'll beat Djokovic, I think, because Djokovic hasn't been playing enough. I think the real the problem is if he has to play Zverev and Tipsy, how do you say his name?
Tsitsipas.
Tsitsipas. If he has to play both of them, I don't like it.
Yeah, I mean we'll plus one of them, draw.
He can beat him. Yeah, I don't have
but
to.
But you know the one thing about
I
Rafa?
I think there's one thing that makes a big difference, though.
Yeah.
3 out of 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the young guys are they can prove they can win it. They can win Masters 1000s. Right. You know, they can ATP Finals.
Playing three sets.
But 2 out of 3 is, and Grand Slam, and like you said, 7 matches in 2 weeks.
Well, if he's rested, different. Nadal is a favorite against anybody. But if he's not, if he's played 5, beating Zverev to play Tiffy, might beat him.
Yeah.
I mean, he almost beats him anyway.
I mean, he's only going to have to either play probably like Tsitsi and Joker, or, you know, Zverev and Tsitsi. You know, he's probably only going to have to play like 2 of those 3 guys to win it all.
But, you know, we say that he might be tired, but you saw what happened in the final last year in Paris when he went through Djokovic, in a heartbeat.
I think Djokovic's out of shape right now. It's just something. He's not motivated.
He looked weird today in his match with Fritz. He got, you know, yelling at the umpire because of the rain. He always seems to be something going on with him. It's like not just the tennis.
The one thing I like about Nadal is that he's only got one thing on his mind, though.
Winning.
That's winning.
Yeah. Winning.
You know, tennis, winning.
Yeah. More.
More.
And you never. Right. And
he's
never
greedy. Which is good.
That's good.
Greed is good in this situation.
He's not going to beat himself. But,
yeah.
Ever.
Some of those other guys, they might, you know, they kind of, you know, might let their mind wander a little bit. They're involved in this or want to do that or meet this person or, you know, whatever. I mean, there's so many distractions out there. You know that.
And, totally.
But for Rafa, you know, and that's, you know, that's to his credit. I mean, there's, you know, to be able to keep all that other stuff away from him as much as he can, you know, that's pretty good.
So, Joker, you said 220 plus 225, team 4-1. Then there's a big drop. Medvedev 16-1. Yeah. Has never won a French Open match. Yeah. Going to be tough to put any money on him. Yeah. Fed 16-1. A little interesting.
No, not to me.
I mean, just
not to win.
Yeah, but I mean, like Tsitsi 16-1, Zverev 20-1.
Those are decent.
Rublev has been pretty hot, 33-1.
No chance.
Schwartzman 33-1. How about this one? Sinner 50-1.
Oh.
Plays Nadal tomorrow in Rome. Tough second round for both guys. They played each other a week or two ago, and Nadal got him. Or no, I'm sorry, Djokovic played him a couple weeks ago.
I'd like to see how that match, how he plays against Nadal before I would. But 50-1, that seems a pretty good value.
Yeah,
you know, for him and his results over the past couple of weeks hasn't been that bad either, has it?
Yeah,
that's a kid you could improve. You could take that guy.
He's got a lot of high ceiling.
And make him up 30%.
Berrettini 66-1.
He's got a hell of a game.
I mean, he's pretty good on clay. He's won tournaments on all three surfaces.
I like his game personally.
Yeah.
I think he's the. I would put him. I would go. You got Nadal, then you've got Zverev or Tips. They're the same, and then you've got Djokovic and Berrettini in my mind as the top.
But when you really look at this, I mean, I think it's hard to not take Nadal.
But Berrettini on really slow clay is different, though. You're right, like on French.
He needs that out.
He needs
like,
that for his serve.
That's the quick.
Yeah, the quickness.
He's got a great forehand.
Oh, his forehand's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But his backhand, you know, if he goes up to somebody who also has a good backhand, they get into those rallies. It's tough.
Somebody who can return his serve.
Yeah. So, But what do you think? I want to ask you guys take on this. RG got pushed back a week because, you know, the French do what they want to do.
Right.
Yeah, but they've done that for a long time.
Right. So last year they moved it back 4 months or whatever it was. This year they moved it back a week. So instead of having 3 weeks of grass leading into Wimbledon, there's only 2. Thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, that's going back to the old days, back when I was playing, you'd play the French and then you'd go and right away was Queens and then a week off and then Wimbledon. Mm-hmm. That's the way it was. So they spread it out a little bit, but over the past, but not this year.
Yeah.
So listen, I like to go and play Queens back in the day because I had the next week off.
Right.
I also wasn't in the finals of the French. You know, I was in the semis a number of times and whatever.
Or you didn't play it, or they kept him out of the French. You know?
Oh yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Well, damn team tennis.
Yeah. Might have had a grand slam.
This is funny now, looking back on knowing what team tennis has been and what it became, that the French would ever think it was like a threat, and that he was held out because he played a couple of matches of team tennis.
I think it was the entire ATP that wasn't. It was everybody.
Well, but I mean, right. But for me, I mean, that kept me from winning the Grand Slam.
No,
I'd won the Australian
and had a shot
at the to play the French, and then I won Wimbledon and U.S. Open after that, but. Hey, listen, a chance at immortality, what can you say?
I still think you're doing okay.
Yeah. not complaining.
Well, what do you think, though? So I always think that grass has been, kind of gets gypped, Like, I think it's cool surface. I mean, I know what you said has been changed over the years, but still, like, visually, it's a totally, still different. You're still getting way lower bounces, and net play and serve is rewarded.
Yeah, some, I guess.
And so I always feel like the fact that there's only a couple weeks and then Wimbledon, that's it. That's the whole, that's what
they should make Queens a bigger tournament then if they want to do that.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask your take. There's talk that maybe they want to make or start a new tournament or make Queens or Halle maybe a Masters 1000 event.
People love Queens. Love to go to.
Yeah, that's going to be a fight to see which one becomes a Masters 1000. Yeah,
well, any day of the week.
You're in London and you got your surroundings and you don't have to get up and move, and even though Halle's not that far. Yeah. I mean, I played Halle and you went with me.
We went 95,
which was a great event back then. Mm-hmm. Just think what it would be now. Mm-hmm. But
that's the only thing about making the case for Halle is think about it. Are there any other grass courts 20 or 15,000 seat stadiums in the world?
Probably,
no,
right, yeah.
So it's kind of crazy that they have that great
and that had a roof before a roof was.
Yeah,
was in.
So that obviously.
I remember going there. 95, we practiced on the outer courts with Richie Rennenberg.
God, you
remember
do
that?
You do have a memory. Yeah. That's right. That's a good memory. You were just a, I don't know how old. Let's see, 95.
14
you
were
14.
Or something.
Yeah.
Richie's a big Wall Street, I think, hedge fund manager.
Is he? Hit us up. We need some picks.
Yeah.
It's been brutal.
Call him up.
And what else? This is funny, just story about that. I remember we flew there. I can't remember where we flew into, but we didn't want to drive. They didn't want us to drive, so they sent a helicopter to, we landed, went through customs, got our bags, and then they loaded us in this helicopter. And we're like, wow, cool, So we take off, and we're flying to Halle, and, the guy's pointing out stuff. Hey, this is the Rhine, and this is, this and all this stuff. And we're like, cool, the headphones on and and the guy's like leaning over and he's like leaning across me and he's pointing stuff out. Like, look down here. This is a sheep farm and this is that. And, and I'm like, cool. And like, I turn to my right to his side and look out his window. And there's like this mini little prop plane.
Oh, I remember that.
Headed.
That's right.
Right at us.
Holy shit.
Like, not far away.
Yeah.
And
it was almost a walk over.
And we're like, hey, over there, and we point, and he just goes like, oh, and just takes the stick and goes, pulls us up and away from this other plane. I always thought that was a funny story.
Those helicopters are dangerous.
We're lucky. Totally. We were lucky we made it.
Dodged one there.
And then on the way back, they didn't want to give us a helicopter after you played. And they'd gotten what they needed. A car for you now. So we took a car on the Autobahn back. Remember, we were going to fly out the next morning. And we're going like 110 or whatever. This guy's driver is like flying on the Autobahn. Boom. Blow a tire.
Holy shit.
Yeah. All of a sudden, and then all of a sudden we're on the side of the road. And so I was like, wow, this is like kind of a risky trip here.
They didn't invite us back either, did they?
No. But yeah, I think, I think it'd be cool to have more grass court tournament.
Well, I can only respond to, to when I was playing, because back when I was playing, they had the tournaments leading up to Wimbledon. Then they had Wimbledon. Then we'd come back. in the United States in play. And then also the U.S. Open was on grass at the beginning.
Yeah, four of your slams are grass.
Yeah.
Right? And the worst, and terrible grass. I mean, we're talking the ball doesn't bounce.
Do you feel like you'd be better today on this grass? Because it kind of seems like it favors rallies and, you know, people who can keep the ball in play, you know, like it's not like bang, 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 quick so much.
Well, I go back and I look and I see Borg, you know, with the way the ball bounces, won five Wimbledons in a row, you know, and he beat some pretty damn good players in the final.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, you know, you know, with those bounces. So, you know, how do you think he would have done, too?
Yeah.
You know, with the way the ball bounces now and the difference of the ball and all that. So, you know, it would have been nice to have had that little extra second to, you know, to be able to step in and hit the ball a little bit earlier. Yeah, but would the ball have gone through the court as much? I don't know. Maybe not.
Maybe
it doesn't go through the court. It doesn't go through the court anymore. And the balls fuzz up after, depending on the surface.
Like
that one, that Palm Springs tournament, what's the Oracle, the owner.
Indian Wells.
But Larry Ellison. They've put, that court eats the ball up, and the ball fluffs up on you.
Yeah, they put so much sand, I guess,
on the ball. So the ball does not go through. It does the opposite.
Really?
It just sits there. Like a kind of like a softer ball that you hit, and it's spongy, and I don't know.
So maybe that's why they've taken away the aggressiveness.
In a way, they have,
you know,
in my opinion.
Of the game, you know, by allowing that. You know, the ball gets so big that, you know, it's easier to run down the equipment and everything they have allows them to be run 3 and 4 and 5 feet outside the court and still whip, you know, with such power and precision, you know, at the same time. So maybe that's been a,
The game that we've guys reasons. Like us. I mean, I'm saying Jimmy, I don't know. I can't speak for him, but we don't have that game. And this guy, watch Tipsy. He's got this. He's kind of a hybrid. He's got the topspin and he's got the attack. I was watching the points and he's doing that thing that Nadal does, where the ball goes in and then
dips.
Falls in.
Dips.
And he's doing that on clay. And whereas his game looks orthodox, but he can do both.
Yeah.
So that's the game, that component nobody that played in our era had because the rackets couldn't
have those grips and stuff.
You'd break your arm trying to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no. So is that harder to do than it's short angling a ball, you know, and drop shotting like the other guys and drop balling and balling better? These guys can't volley, most of them, not all of them.
I think it's tough. It's like it's almost lame to try and compare because like the people who played in the different eras, like their games evolved and grew up with what the stuff, you know, the equipment was at the time. And the balls and all that stuff. So like when they're like, well, you know, what would you, Connors, play against Fed now or whatever? Well, if you guys played at the same time, your guys' games would have evolved differently. You know what I mean? Right. Like, you would have been able to have a bigger serve if you played with those big rackets as a kid.
You think?
Well, you know what I mean.
No. A lot of it's size, though. If the guy like that is arcing that ball back on you on the baseline, and he's able to do that off a good shot, and it's a defensive shot.
Yeah.
And you're not 6'3", that's going to hurt you if you're on the baseline and that ball bounces in because you're going to be up here.
Like when you learned, you almost didn't, a lot of people almost just put the ball in play. You would almost, you just spin it in play to start the point a little bit, you know, like it wasn't looked at as like, this is the biggest weapon in the game.
Serve well.
You know,
right.
Where like now it is, you know, like we'll look at Wimbledon, how like that's why they changed it, is because it became so fucking unwatchable, you know, like just boom, boom. And by the second week, the grass is trash and there's no bounce.
You had Sampras who, you know, one of the greatest servers of all time.
Yeah.
Great. So I think
like even Ivanišević and like those, I mean, you know, great players and everything, but just to watch it is not. Yeah.
Well, you didn't have, but it's who the matchup is. If you have Sampras playing guys returning, it's going to be a great match.
Yeah.
If you have a guy who can't return, it's going to be boring. Now, if you have two guys that just belt the ball from 5 feet behind the baseline and run side to side, that's boring. So you've gone too far the other way. That's all I'm saying. Maybe it was too far with, you know, Sampras came up. You didn't have, like, Jimbo playing Borg and McEnroe, guys that kind of did everything. Mm-hmm. Sampras could do everything, but he was just so good at serving big and so fast and had a huge forehand that he didn't He didn't need to hit five balls.
Yeah.
So, but then the other hand, you have these guys that are rallying like it's a workout. 5-7 cross-court backhands, 5 cross-court forehands, 6 blah, blah, blah.
Like almost like it's a drill.
Exactly. So it's you know, you need in between.
So we talked about, you know, a lot of those playing the French What about Americans? We don't have any Americans up there. They're even talking about, do we?
I think that's because
for the men.
Think about
for
it.
The men, right? Yeah.
So L.A. Southern Cal was the center when we and everything was fast courts, grass courts, and then clay in Europe, right? In summer, some clay in the United States. I think it's almost the reverse. The clay's, the cement's been slowed. So there's no advantage to growing up on cement courts. It's a disadvantage. So you took out the western part of the United States out of tennis, basically. You got to be in Florida.
Right, yeah.
And you got to be playing in Florida. And then still you're playing on a different type of clay in a way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not the same. That
it's not the same. And so I think that's one of the reasons. And I think the other reason is the system here where you have pros that aren't really, they're coaching the kids, they're not really supported by the USTA. The USTA takes the kid to their 100-court complex and gives them a new coach, maybe tells them changes his game. They got to make it more fun for the kids in the United States to play. You're up there on teams, they play other clubs first, and then if they get really good, they play for their federation against another federation. I mean, everything's a team, they get all these perks.
Yeah.
I don't know kind of what's really going on now in junior tennis here, but it just seems like, at least from the East Coast, they're not making it fun enough for these young kids.
Yeah, no American men in the top 30 since time began. No, just since that's the ranking system began.
Well, that's
used to
about
be the
time,
reverse,
which is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I guess the top American that would be Taylor Fritz.
Fritz, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know,
he's like 30-something, 31, maybe he's 30.
Right.
Yeah.
Isner was a top American for a while, and you know, his results haven't been. Sam Querrey hasn't, his results are, you know, haven't been up to standard. So, you know, so you have, who's the young kid coming up? Korda.
He's got big, Sebastian I watched Korda. Him, I saw him play in Del Rey.
Yeah.
He's got a tremendous talent. You know, he's 6'3" or 4".
He's a big kid.
Big serving.
Moves pretty good, though, for a big kid.
Moves very well. Can serve and volley, can approach with the backhand. Forehand, he's a little slappy, but it's big. So, I mean, if you play him high in that rally game that they do, he's built for that.
Yeah, but he's young. He's what, 17, 18?
Yeah,
you know, 18, so, I think.
He's got a lot of improving to do.
He's got some improving to do. Yeah. But it seems like, you know, the men seem to be struggling a bit, you know, and with nobody in the top 30. But the women are crushing it.
Right.
You know.
Two players in the top 10.
Right. But so it makes, what's the difference? You know, why are the women crushing it and two in the top 10? And, you know, you've got
Kennan,
you got Serena still, you've got Sloane Stephens.
Keys.
Yeah. So
she's got a great, I love her game.
So
Allison Risk. I mean, you got a lot of depth. 16, Anna Samova, Goff. You know, there's the future right there.
Those she's two, been talking Kennan. About her for 2 years already. Almost forget about her. And she's, what, 16, 17
what's
now?
What's she ranked in the world?
Brady. You know, Brady's made the semis and the finals the last two slams. You know, Shelby Rogers is 43. I mean, there's 16 American women in the top 100.
Right.
There's 10 men. So it's not like it's, you know, we're struggling to have anybody, but it's just our guys don't start till 31.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, it seems like, you know, Querrey and Stevie Johnson and Sangren and Isner, you know, they're kind of on the second part of their career.
Also get older, right?
You know, and as far as the guys coming up, it seems to be Fritz and Korda.
Well, yeah. Fritz is...
Tiafo, but he seems to have hit a wall the last couple of years with his improving.
Shaky forehand.
Yeah, he's kind of a weird grip. And he's a nice kid. He's, you know, really athletic and fast.
Well, he's a great athlete.
Yeah. But I don't know. He seemed to, like, kind of hit a wall, like, you know, let's see where he's at. But what do you think? I mean, I stand by that the reason the women are so much better, you know, quote unquote better than the men, is that the American talent for men's athletics,
all right,
it gets spread thinner.
Maybe, yeah.
Because there's so much money to be made and, you know, scholarships to be had playing so many different sports. Whereas with the women, there's, you know, less scholarships because there's always more for men, and then there's less money to be made playing, you know, WNBA or soccer, mm-hmm,
right,
or
so
like hockey.
The tremendous athletes aren't playing tennis on men's. Maybe that's what's happening. I mean, look at got Korda. He's 6'4", 6'5", but you don't have a lot of fast. Fritz is a hell of a tennis player. I don't think he's as athletic as Korda, So you could argue that there must be, you know, a numerous other great athletes that aren't playing tennis, that are playing basketball, that are playing football.
Mm-hmm. You know? That's what I think. Yeah. And I think if you have talent, you're an athlete and you're a woman, you know, like you get funneled or channeled into golf and into tennis, because it's like, look, you know, money for one, for sure, but also just even like education, you know, a job, or you get into like a sport and then, you know, become a trainer, you become something affiliated with the sport. There's so much money in these two sports that like they suck up all the, like, you know, female talent in the country. In the world, really, you know, like, look at Asia, how many amazing golfers, you know, come from Asia. And then you talk about Korda. Korda's two sisters are like top 10. Top 10 golfers in the world.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Two top 10 golfers and a top 40 tennis player. It's like, how's that family doing?
Yeah.
And it's also individual sports don't attract as many, at least in the United States. It's not as fun. They don't make it like a great, you go on a team, these kids celebrate in the band, you know, they're 12 years old, they're all partying afterwards. Great, you know, camaraderie. Tennis, the parents are yelling at them. The parents are ready to get in fights on the sidelines with each other. It's an isolated thing. I mean, it's a different.
And it's an expensive sport. Expensive.
But also playing an individual sport is that's all on you.
Yeah.
You know, so there are, that's a certain group of people and athletes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's not for everybody.
Right.
You know, a lot of guys like to be covered.
Or blend in.
Or blend, right. Blend in is
and
a better
excel for a moment, and they can't have to, you don't have to excel all the time.
Right.
Yeah. Or you can pick when you want to excel or whatever.
But the weird part to me is that the way tennis is that, especially in the U.S., all you have to be is the top two or three American, you know, tennis player, or even top five. And you get to say, I'm the top five in my sport in the world from this country.
All right.
You know, we're like, how many great football players are from America? You know, there's like every pro, almost 80-90% of the pro bowlers are probably American.
Right.
You know, there's tons of great NBA basketball players that are American. The top whatever out of blank are American. But like tennis, if you can just excel and be one of the top five, you know, you become the shit to like advertisers. Like, I'm one of the top five players in the world. That's like having,
because of the market.
You said. Like, you know, like LeBron is like, let's say one, you know, in the world. So that's the number one tennis, number one American.
Yeah.
So then like the fifth guy would be the equivalent of like, I don't know, who's the fifth best player, like Dwayne Wade or like somebody who's great, you know, in basketball terms, the fifth guy is great.
Not good, but he's making a fortune though.
Where in tennis, if you can be a top five or 10 American, you're going to make a pretty good career because you'll get sponsors because you're American and like the American companies are going to want to sponsor an American kid and that kind of stuff. So I always.
Yeah, but you're also competing against so many other sports and so many other players for every job. You know, you talked about, you know, endorsements and things. You know, you're up against basketball, baseball, football, you know, tennis, golf. You know, you're fighting against so many. But let's say Masayama, you know, just won the Masters. He created a new number.
Said that could be worth $1 billion.
Yeah, I mean, but if he did that over here. No,
yeah,
it'd be different because he's jumping up against so many other great athletes and everything. But over there, it's a one of a kind. I think he's the first Japanese player to win a major. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, where's that put him?
Yeah,
you know,
legend status forever.
Legend.
Now. Yeah,
after one.
Yeah. Well, somebody's got to be the first.
Yeah, but only after one Grand Slam. I mean, and they're saying that already. You know, not that he's not going to win more. I hope he does. I like him.
Well,
I
like one is more important than if he won the next 10. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's one.
Got him started.
When he's that guy forever.
Right.
So now every kid's going to be like, Matsuyama.
Right.
You know, like, why'd you start playing? Matsuyama. Right. I saw Matsuyama wear the green jacket, you know? And that'll, like, spark a generation of kids that are going to get into the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you almost want to be first more than like get two or three,
because
you know it becomes immortalized.
Yeah, you're right. Number one is the best. You're right.
Yeah,
and I, you know, I like watching him play. You know, I work not work at it, but I try to get better at my golf game. And watching him swing, you know, is good for me because he swings so slow.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he used to have that little hesitation at the top.
Yeah,
remember that?
And I like that because I could actually see, you know, and you know, as opposed to, you know, a lot of the other players, they swing so fast. I mean, if you blink, you missed it. But you know, I could catch him, and I was happy that he won, because it created more interest and more excitement for golf, which I like to see. And then the other thing in golf,
he seems like a nice guy. Yeah, he's cool.
And the other thing I like to see is Spieth, Jordan Spieth, who had such a run like 3, 4, 5 years ago, and then fell upon hard times. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, I'm saying with the utmost humility, I mean, they wrote me off in 78, 79, when I didn't win a Grand Slam for 3 years. And it's easy to take a guy who has been on top, falls upon hard times, and say, next, you know, next. And that he stayed in there, whether he changed his game, he changed his attitude, whatever, he came back and has had one hell of a year.
Yeah.
A number, 3 or 4 seconds, and then he won a tournament. Mm-hmm. And to see somebody like that fight through the bad times, you know, I wish him nothing but success, you know, to have come out of that. I mean, there's a lot of other guys who probably did it also, and I'm not saying that. He's just the latest.
Interesting to see someone come and burn so bright. Because the thing that pops in my head is a little bit like Duvall. You know, he maybe wasn't around as long as Duvall, but Duvall came on the scene, had those like couple years. I mean, remember he shot like 59
in Palm Springs
on a Sunday to win it.
Right.
Not just some like, oh, I was at the back of the field, you know, 59. Ooh. He won it with the 59. You know, he won the British. He won in like 2 or 3 tournaments. He won like 3 tournaments in a row 1 year, which is a lot in golf. It's hard to win back to back. And then he kind of fell off, but never had the total comeback that hopefully Spieth can have, because I like him too.
Yeah.
One thing, you said you work on your game a little bit.
Work is a wrong word.
Did you hear that, Spencer?
Yeah.
Did you hear what happened a couple weeks ago with this guy?
I know. Did he clean out the entire club there?
11th.
Whoa.
Hole in one.
Wow.
I did.
11?
That's good.
It's disgusting.
That's fantastic.
Now, it was...
talk us through it.
Well, let me give it to you. We pulled up to the ninth.
Where were you playing?
We were playing Glen Annie, a course in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
175 yards. Mm-hmm. And
Any wind?
Just a slight little breeze, you know, but...
your face, at your back?
Just a little right to left down.
Okay.
And... So I just got this new set of clubs.
What'd you get? got to give us some details.
All right, I got the new Mavericks, okay. and they're hot.
You like them?
And yes, I do. So I pulled out my club and I stepped up there and I just said, you know, I had a kind of a rough hole the one before, and I said I'm just going to get up there and think what I've been doing and trying to improve on. And I hit it and I striped it. And our buddy Jerry,
you hit?
I hit an 8-iron. And my buddy, our buddy Jerry says, that's going to be close. That's a hole in one. That's good, you know, like that. And I bent down and I picked.
Wait. He said it's going to be
a hole
in one.
He says that's going to be close.
Jerry Fall, the ultimate cooler.
The cooler.
Of all time coolers.
I said,
that usually means it's going to bounce out of the hole.
That's what I thought.
Out of bounds.
I thought it was going to go over the green. I had a little downwind. So we're playing a fivesome. We pull up, and there's only 4 balls around close on the green and around the green. So I said, "Ah, Christ!" So I went back and I got my wedges. I thought I'd gone over.
Yeah.
So I went back and got my wedges, and Jerry walks by the hole and he says, "What's down there?" I go, "Oh my God! I didn't see it." You know,
because didn't get to see it go in.
No, I bent down to pick up the tee and kind of move on, it was pretty exciting, I will say. I've had 11. I don't get me wrong. I am a bad golfer, you know, but I love trying to get better. But it just goes to show. I mean, I know there's guys out there.
I mean, 11's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
I saw, just to get in here, I saw a clip, I don't know when it was, over the last, in the last year, of John Daly. And John Daly's playing through some guys at some course. And John Daly plays like barefoot. You know, he's a legend. And the guys are letting him play through, so they're filming him. Hits it, you know, he's like, okay, thanks. Kind of the same thing, goes to pick it up. And then they're like, oh, it's in the hall, you know, in the hall. So they, you know, everyone's going crazy. And someone goes, how many is that, John? 11. Right. And that's John Daly. Yeah, you know, John Daly's probably played a few rounds of golf.
Yeah,
he's pretty good at it. So
I'd say that puts me in some damn good company.
That's pretty good right there. I've only seen you do one. I've never had one. Have you had one, Spence?
No.
So, yeah, maybe you could let us borrow one or two. So what do? You have everyone sign the ball?
I do.
And then do you keep them in a special place?
I do. I have them in my Wimbledon doubles trophy. I kind of stack them
with
up.
Uncle Nasty?
Well, yeah. Yeah, so, and I put the date on it, and it's pretty exciting. It was, you know, you think that, oh, okay, but you don't know how rare that is. You know,
well, yeah, that's the thing is, how many times have you just holed out from like 150 from a fairway?
Not often. Once.
Less than like five, probably,
oh,
right?
Oh, once. Yeah. I know, just one time.
Whoa. Which makes it like more ridiculous. You know, like you're not holing out, you know, once in a while, making a hole in one once in a while. You have 11 hole in ones and one or two hole outs.
Yeah, it was, you know, it goes to show.
I hate you.
Christ, but it's so exciting every time.
Yeah.
You know, that's the key. I mean, when I went to pick that up, I didn't even get it out of the hole. And I said, where's the pen? Hey, you know, come on, sign it, you know, to get it. And then I went home and I put it in my on my little trophy case. Pretty cool.
That's great. One problem, though. Fivesome? Hole in one negated. Yeah. Sorry. Just kidding. We'll let it slide. All right. I can see Spencer's getting a little antsy. We'll get wrapped up here. But Spence, I want to talk to you. Yeah. You made your career in the financial world. Talk to me about like everything that's gone on with the crypto and the GameStop and all that stuff. Talk to me about that and talk to me a little bit about like, you know, your work and everything.
Well, I'm more in the private equity kind of venture capital. When I was a lawyer in L.A. and a tennis enthusiast named Ted Forsman, who is the sponsor of the Huggy Bear. I don't know if you remember him. He's passed away now, but he was also a famous financier. He loved tennis, and he gave me a shot to go to New York when I was already in my 40s. And I was in entertainment. I've been an entertainment lawyer. I was in real estate development. I was like the guy who didn't really like any of his jobs. So I ended up going to New York and getting into the place I could really only get into was early stage companies, the hardest to finance and the most risk. And I was very lucky in that, but I learned a lot. But in terms of the crypto, because I was around technology a lot, not an expert on technology, but I was around how do you finance these companies and what kind of huge risk they have and sort of get, I have a lot of experience with them in terms of how they build a company in technology. And crypto is like, it's almost another world. You're talking about, well, it's the currency aspect, but the technology behind crypto is this enabling technology called blockchain. Mm-hmm. And crypto, the currencies itself, I'm not an expert, I do know that what's happened is the younger people are looking at crypto like the older people used to look at gold. It's something that cannot be so inflated by the creation of more of it so easily. So they feel confident that this is, and because of the trading and the secrecy and all that, they view it as an alternative currency which cannot be distorted by the government, okay? So the younger people are buying into that. And so gold, which is like that, but actually there's a ton of gold in not just gold coins, there's gold in people's houses and their jewelry. But so you really, it's not as finite, they don't perceive it as being as finite as crypto. So that's a large reason for younger people are buying it and holding it and looking at it as money in the bank that can go up and over time will be accepted. Each currency is different, but and there's going to be a whole world of companies in blockchain that are going to explode in the next, that are going to do well, not currency plays, but things that are going to enable different things on tech. I'm in one deal called True Tickets, which is I'm an investor in it. It basically enables on electronic tickets for the venue, you know, the theater, or to track the ticket all the way through and receive a commission and control that for the ticket. They know who the ticket is. So in COVID times, you know who sat two seats away at that seat. And so
scalpers don't like that.
Yeah, they don't get a
hate. They don't like you, dude.
Not me. I'm just an investor. These guys are at MIT and super smart guys. But so I got involved more in the side of financing these early stage companies. And I'm proud to announce I got one of the most conservative investors in my last deal. Mr. Connors.
To the moon. Let's go.
Yeah, so we're doing a crazy deal. Not crazy in the sense that I never did biotech, but I got intrigued by this because I thought I wouldn't get caught up in having to finance an entire biotech company. Male pattern baldness, which is very interesting. You lose your hair as you get older, 65% of all men. And when they lose their hair, the hair is alive under the skin. The follicle doesn't grow anymore. Mm-hmm. Hair grows and falls out in the cycle. So now, as you get older, testosterone blocks the signals at the base of your hair follicle. Okay. And your hair doesn't regrow. So gradually it thins and thins and thins, and then all of a sudden you're bald, depending on how bad you got it, right? Mm-hmm. This professor at UC Irvine, very famous guy in hair, studying it, saw these moles on people that had all this hair. You know, you've seen, like, I always think of the Wicked Witch of the West.
A bunch
of hair coming out, but like 20 hairs out of a little mole. Yeah. So he saw these studies on bald guys with big moles and tons of hair. He said, well, what is in the mole that resists this testosterone blocking the signal? He figured out what that was, and now we've basically licensed that technology. We take mice that are special immune-suppressed mice. We take human skin from the back of your head that has hair follicle, and we are growing that hair in record time that shows that we're stimulating the growth. So now, if we can patent it, which we don't know we can, or if we can, then we're going to the next level. We did it on, so we got a very big proof of concept, and now we're going out to raise serious money. And then I have a migraine. So I don't ever do startups anymore. I'm too old for that. But I found a company that was in distressed, which is a really venture company, has a device that uses the MRI pulse, which is a transmagnetic pulse, to quiet your brain and to prevent migraine. It's a huge problem. FDA approved device built by the guys who built the Cypher stent for J&J. Mm-hmm. They spent $72 million perfecting this and had $20 million of debt, and they couldn't refinance the company. I got involved with the CEO, and we've restarted it. And nice. That's a huge play because it's basically a women's disease. 36 million people in America, I think about 70% are women. A third of them have serious migraines, like 4 or 5 a month. You have a migraine, you lose 2 days of work generally. Mm. So we're there to prevent migraines. And Jimbo can give a lot of guys a migraine on the court, so I'm going to sell a lot.
You're just trying to help the workforce, trying to get those people back to their jobs.
Back to their job.
Get back.
But here's what I mean.
Back to work.
Let me give you the good part. No side effects. Approved by the FDA.
What's the name? Is there a way to invest? How do they invest?
Well, we haven't done that yet. We're going out with a private placement. Right now you can go to the website. So when we took it over, they had no money, so we basically slowly brought it back. We've redone the website only slightly. It's Eneura. And here's the big thing about it. No side effects at all. You can use it as much as you want. It communicates. They send you the device. They turn it on. And all of a sudden, your data is being transmitted to the cloud. So then the doctor gets to see how many times you're using it. They send you a log once a month. You describe your progress with it. And unlike drugs, serious side effects, they don't know if you're using the drugs, or the insurance companies don't. So our only hurdle is getting the insurance companies to pay for it now. And we're 1/3 the cost of the major drugs that prevent migraine, and we're about, and we're no side effects, as I've said 100 times. So I think we have a real shot on that one. So nice. That, it gets me going, keeps me busy.
And I got to just say one thing. If I'm an investor and working with him, it's time for him to get back to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, the markets have been like tremendous, and I'm probably catching the tail end of it now. But for instance, this technology, transcranial magnetic pulse that does the migraines, it's already out there in 2 public companies that do depression. So if you're depressed, you go to a shrink's office. They have a huge machine. It goes around your head and sends the same thing that we do, but we do it portable at home. But those companies are valued in the hundreds of millions. and they're basically just getting going. So it's one of those kind of moonshot things. The market's so big that if you, and we're already FDA approved.
Yeah.
So $72 million into the company before I got a hold of it for next to Pupkis.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I have a stock that I like. It's it deals with like some of the stuff you're saying, depression and like addiction. It's called MNMD, Mind Medicine.
Okay.
And just got put on the NASDAQ. It's like $3 a share.
Is it a drug?
Yeah, it's a like a bio that's going to start doing research. They're already doing research, but with like psilocybin, which is the drug in mushrooms.
Right.
You know, and probably eventually like DMT and like these, you know, quote unquote drugs that have been had like a negative connotation or been criminalized for so long. They're going to hopefully open up the restrictions and let testing, you know, and then, you know, they're not going to use huge doses. You know, they're going to use small doses of the thing and it's supposed to help a lot with like depression.
Yeah. I mean, the addiction problem, it's fascinating. It sounds great, but the amount of money you have to spend on these trials. To show that it's safe first and then that it works second, are so huge that generally you need these big partners. So your real risk, you could have the greatest thing in the world, is that you can't raise enough money to get through to that.
All the proof. And the FDA, all the hoops they make.
Yeah, so I'm never do biotech, but whereas the migraine's already proven that it works, whereas the hair thing, we have to prove it works, but hair is such a huge problem and it's never paid for by insurance. Mm-hmm. If you lost your hair and you want it, people pay a ton for that. So we think that one of the big drug companies, if we get these things positioned right, would take it over and finish it. We would never have to go all the way with the through the FDA. But so you have to have your strategy for these companies. And I'm no scientist, but the one thing you've learned about COVID, science changes every day. One day they think, it's 4 feet away. Next day it's, it's just be in the room and mask works. That's how science is. You never know. It's evolving as you do it. And so you're gambling your life when you, if you bet a ton of money in these things, you can lose a ton very easily.
I think the one interesting thing about the crypto is how that was the first thing the first time we ever heard blockchain was with the crypto. But now that technology is like, it's bleeding into everything.
And the guys that lead in that.
NFTs and all that stuff.
There's going to be huge companies built in crypto.
Yeah.
They're already there. They're just, you're just hearing about them now.
Yeah, like Coinbase went public. Did you see that? I mean, like the rapper Nas, who's just one of the like greatest rappers from New York.
Yeah.
$500,000 investment, $100 million.
Found out $100 million, but did he get out?
I mean, probably. I think they made the share so you could, because the main dude sold like the first 2 days or something.
See, that's amazing. Like, my big home run was a company called Next Level.
And you had to wait.
And it went to $22 billion market cap. We did the deal at 100. And you had to wait 6 months of the lockup.
After it went public?
Yeah, and then everybody's selling. So generally what happens is all the
tanks.
And tanks.
How long did you have to wait with Argosy?
I had one of those.
Yeah,
Argosy came out in
gaming company,
which is riverboat gaming company back.
Perfect timing.
It was great timing. It was the first riverboat, and when it came out, we had a partner share that we could sell, but we had to hold for a number of time, and our stock shot up to 39.40, and
you're just sitting there.
And
paper money's fun.
Yeah, but
it's a real company, probably Argosy. Whereas most of these tech companies, they don't have earnings.
It's just nothing.
Right. Like those depression companies I'm telling you about.
Yeah, nothing.
So no, and you got to buy. So give you an example: the business model on the depression. You got to buy a $200,000 machine, and the shrink has to buy it, and then you got to go to the shrink's office, and use that. Now, it costs the shrink a ton, right? Our thing. It's $1,200,
portable.
You'd use it every day, much as you want. Rent it for $350.
Is it only good for migraine?
We've only proven with the FDA it's good for migraine, but it's common sense that the mechanism of migraine is very similar, fibromyalgia, epilepsy. It's the level you send this thing into the brain. So we're sending it into the back of the brain, not tremendously deep, because you need a huge electric source. So the big machine is to send it for depression. It's going way deep.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's this the future. Like this, what's his name?
Musk.
He's involved a lot with the brain, but he's on another level. He's trying to do way more ambitious things than this. MRI pulses are safe. Mm-hmm. He's doing stuff like he wants to put electrodes in your brain.
He wants to put a chip in, right?
Yeah. I mean,
the monkeys he's so testing on and shit. You seen that? He's or got they play Pong with each other.
Yeah, he's got that brain. Kind of money. He can do that. He can screw around with that. But he's a brilliant guy. But that's really ambitious.
Yeah. All right, guys.
We talked forever. It's been fun.
It's been fun. I'm glad to get you in town, Spence.
Thank you.
Give my best to the fam.
I will.
Pops, any last words?
Yeah, follow us, Advantage Connors. And, get in touch with us on Twitter at Jimmy Connors and follow Brett.
Yeah, follow me at Brett _Connors, him at Jimmy Connors. You can follow us on Twitter at ADV Connors, Instagram at Advantage Connors. All right, guys, it's been fun.
Good being with you,
brother. Talk to you soon, and Spence, we'll get you on here again.
Thanks a lot.
Love it, man.
A lot of fun.
Bye.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.